I had a sense of great ease and spaciousness, and my happiness had a strange, remembered quality, as though I had lived it before. Oh, how can I recapture it, that utterly right, homecoming sense of recognition? It seems to me now that the whole day was like an avenue leading to a home I had loved once but forgotten, the memory of which was coming back so dimly, so gradually, as I wandered along, that only when my home at last lay before me did I cry, "Now I know why I have been happy." How words weave spells. As I wrote of the avenue, it rose before my eyes. I can see it now, lined with great smooth trunk trees, whose branches meet far above me. The still air is flooded with peace, yet somehow expectant, as it seemed to me once when I was in King's Crypt Cathedral at sunset. On and on I wander, beneath the vaulted roof of branch and leaf, and all the time the avenue is yesterday, that long approach to beauty. Images in the mind, how strange they are. I have been gazing at the sky. I never saw it a brighter blue. Great featherbed clouds are billowing across the sun, their edges brilliant silver. The whole day is silvery, sparkling. The birds sound shrill. Yesterday was golden. Even in the morning the light was softly drowsy. All sounds seemed muted. By 10 o'clock I had finished all my jobs and was wondering what to do with the morning. I strolled round the garden, watched a thrush on the lawn listening for worms, and finally came to rest on the grassy bank of the moat. When I dabbled my hand in the shimmering water, it was so much warmer than I expected that I decided to bathe. I swam round the castle twice, hearing the Handel water music in my head. While I was hanging my bathing suit out of the bedroom window, I had a sudden longing to lie in the sun with nothing on. I never felt it before. Topaz has always had a monopoly of nudity in our household. But the more I thought of it, the more I fancied it. And I had the brilliant idea of doing my sunbathing on the top of the bedroom tower, where nobody working in the fields or wandering up our lane could possibly see me. It felt most peculiar crawling naked up the cold, rough stone steps. Exciting in some mysterious way I couldn't explain to myself. Coming out at the top was glorious. Warmth and light fell round me like a great cape. The leads were so hot they almost burnt the soles of my feet. I was glad I'd thought of bringing up a blanket to spread. It was beautifully private. That tower is the best preserved of them all. The circle of battlements is complete, though there are a few deep cracks. A marigold had seeded in one of them. Once I lay down flat, I couldn't even see the battlements without turning my head. There was nothing left but the sun-filled dome of the cloudless sky. What a difference there is between wearing even the skimpiest bathing suit and wearing nothing. After a few minutes, I seemed to live in every inch of my body as fully as I usually do in my head and my hands and my heart. I had the fascinating feeling that I could think as easily with my limbs as with my brain. And suddenly the whole of me thought that Topaz's nonsense about communing with nature isn't nonsense at all. The warmth of the sun felt like enormous hands pressing gently on me. The flutter of the air was like delicate fingers. My kind of nature worship has always had to do with magic and folklore, though sometimes it turned a bit holy. This was nothing like that. I expect it was what Topaz means by pagan. Anyway, it was thrilling. But my front got so terribly hot, and when I rolled over on my stomach, I found that the back of me was not so interested in communing with nature. I began to think with my brain only, in the normal way. And it felt rather shut inside itself. Probably because having nothing but the roof to stare at was very dull. I started to listen to the silence. Never have I known such a silent morning. No dog barked. No hen clucked. Strangest of all, no bird sang. I seemed to be in a soundless globe of heat. The thought had just struck me that I might have gone deaf when I heard a tiny bead of sound. Tap, tap. I couldn't imagine what it could be. Plop, plop. I solved it. My bathing suit dripping into the moat. Then a bee zoomed into the marigold close to my ear. And then suddenly, it was as if all the bees of the summer world were humming high in the sky. I sprang up and saw an aeroplane coming nearer and nearer, so I made for the stairs and sat there with just my head out. The plane flew quite low over the castle. And the ridiculous idea came to me that I was a medieval de goddess lady seeing a flying man across the centuries, and perhaps hoping he was a lover coming to win her. After that, the medieval lady groped her way downstairs and put on her shift. Just as I finished dressing, the postman came through to the courtyard calling, "Anyone home?" He had a parcel for me. Rose had gone back and ordered the Midsummer Eve scent. I thought she had forgotten. Oh, it was a fascinating present. Inside the outer wrapping was another, white with coloured flowers on it, and inside that was a blue box that felt velvety, and inside that was a glass bottle engraved with a moon and stars, and inside that was pale green scent. The stopper was fastened down with silver wire and silver seals. At first I thought I would open it at once. Then I decided to make the opening a prelude to the rites, something to look forward to all day. So I stood the bottle on the half of the dressing table that used to be Rose's and sent her waves of thanks. I meant to write to her after my goings-on on Belmont, as she called them, and tell her I had worn the scent for them. Oh, why didn't I write at once? What can I say to her now? I was hungry, but I didn't feel like cooking, so I had the most beautiful lunch of cold-baked beans. What bliss it is that we can now afford things in tins again. I had bread and butter, too, and lettuce, and cold rice pudding, and 2 slices of cake. Real shop cake. And milk. Hel and Ab sat on the table and were given treats. They had had their own dinners, of course. They both took to baked beans at once. There is precious little they don't take to. Heloise even accepted salted lettuce. During our famine period, she became practically a vegetarian. Then, all three of us very full, we had a sleep in the four-poster. Ab curled up at the foot and Hel with her back against my chest, which was rather hot but always gives one a companionable feeling. We slept for hours. I don't think I ever slept so long in the daytime. I felt terribly guilty when I woke up and found it was nearly 4 o'clock. Hel thumped her tail as if I had just come back from somewhere, and Ab gave us a look as if he had never seen either of us before in his life, after which he jumped off the bed, did a little claw sharpening on Miss Blossom's solitary leg, and then went downstairs. When I looked out across the courtyard a few minutes later, he was high on the curtain walls with one leg pointing to heaven, doing some strenuous washing. It gave me the idea of washing my hair. After that, it was time to gather flowers for the rites. They have to be wildflowers. I can't remember if that is traditional or if Rose and I made it up. Mallow, campion and bluebells for the garland to hang round our necks. Foxgloves to carry. And we always wore wild roses in our hair. Even since Rose has given up the rites, she has sometimes come out for the garland gathering. I kept talking to her yesterday and hearing her answer. It made me miss her more than ever, so I talked to Heloise instead. We had the most peaceful, companionable walk along the lane and through the fields, with Heloise carrying the flower basket for several seconds at a time, the whole back half of her waggling with pride. I was glad to find there were still plenty of bluebells in the larch wood. One of the nicest sights I know is Heloise smelling a bluebell with her long, white, naked-looking nose. How can people say bull terriers are ugly? Heloise is exquisite, though she has put on a bit too much weight these last opulent weeks. I gave the flowers a long drink. Wild ones die so quickly without water that I never make my garland before 7 o'clock. By then I had collected enough twigs to start the fire. Stephen always takes the logs up for me, and pack my basket. When I finished my garland, it was nearly 8, and a pale moon was coming up, though the sky was still blue. I changed into my green linen frock and put on my garland and wild roses. Then, at the very last minute, I opened Rose's scent. One deep sniff, and I was back in the rich shop where the furs were stored. Oh, it was a glorious smell. But the odd thing was, it no longer reminded me of bluebells. I waved a little about on a handkerchief and managed to capture them for a second. But most of the time there was just a mysterious, elusive sweetness that stood for London and luxury. It killed the faint wildflower scents, and I knew it would spoil the lovely smell that comes from Belmont grass after a hot day. So I decided not to wear any for the rites. I took one last sniff, then ran down to the kitchen for the sack of twigs and the basket and started off. I was glad Heloise wasn't there to follow me, because she always wants to eat the ceremonial cake. There wasn't a breath of wind as I climbed the mound. The sun was down. Usually I begin the rites by watching it sink, but trying the scent had taken longer than I realized. The sky beyond Belmont Tower was a watery yellow with one streak of green across it, vivid green, most magically beautiful. But it faded quickly. It was gone by the time I reached the stones we placed to encircle the fire. I watched until the yellow faded too, then turned towards the moon still low over the wheat field. The blue all around her had deepened so much that she no longer looked pale, but like masses of luminous snow. The peace was so great that it seemed like a soft, thick substance wrapped closely round me, making it hard to move. But when the church clock struck 9, I stirred at last. I emptied the sack of twigs into the circle of stones and put on the small logs that Stephen had left ready. He had brought some long, slender branches too, so I set them up over the logs like the poles of a wigwam. Then I went to the tower for my need fire. Real need fire, from which midsummer fires should be lit, can only be made by rubbing 2 pieces of wood together. But when we first planned the rites, Rose and I spent an hour at this without raising so much as a spark. So we decided it would be pagan enough if we took matches to the tower and lit a taper. Then Rose carried it out and I followed, waving foxgloves. We were always fascinated that such a tiny flame could make the twilight seem deeper and so much more blue. We thought of that as the beginning of the magic, and it was tremendously important that the taper shouldn't blow out as we came down the tower steps and crossed the mound. On breezy nights, we used a lamp glass to protect it. Last night was so still that I scarcely needed to shelter it with my hand. Once the fire is blazing, the countryside fades into the dusk. So I took one last look round the quiet fields, sorry to let them go. Then I lit the twigs. They caught quickly. I love those early minutes of a fire, the crackles and snappings, the delicate flickers, the first sharp whiff of smoke. The logs were slow to catch, so I lay with my head near the ground and blew. Suddenly the flames raced up the wigwam of branches, and I saw the snowy moon trapped in a fiery cage. Then smoke swept over her as the logs caught at last. I scrambled up and sat back watching them blaze high. All my thoughts seemed drawn into the fire, to be burning with it in the brightly lit circle of stones. The whole world seemed filled with hissing and crackling and roaring. And then far off in the forgotten dusk someone called my name. Cassandra! Did it come from the lane? Or from the castle? And whose voice was it? Dead still, I waited for it to call again, trying to shut my ears to the fire noises. Had it been a man's voice or a woman's? When I tried to remember it, I only heard the fire. After a few seconds, I began to think I must have imagined it. Then Heloise began barking, the way she barks when somebody arrives. I ran across the mound and peered down. At first my eyes were too full of the flames to see anything clearly, then gradually the pale light of evening spread round me again. But I couldn't see into the lane or the courtyard because a thick mist was rising from the moat. Heloise sounded so frantic that I decided to go down. Just as I started off, she stopped barking. And then, floating across the mist, came the voice again. Cassandra! A long, drawn-out call. This time, I knew it was a man's voice, but I still couldn't recognize it. I was sure it wasn't Father's, or Stephen's, or Thomas's. It was a voice that had never called me before. Here I am, I called back. Who is it? Someone was moving through the mist, crossing the bridge. Heloise came racing ahead, very pleased with herself. Why, of course, it'll be Neil, I thought suddenly, and started to run down to meet him. Then at last I saw clearly. It wasn't Neil. It was Simon. Oh, strange to remember. I wasn't pleased to see him. I had wanted it to be Neil, if it had to be anyone at all when I was just starting the rites. I wouldn't blame anybody who caught a grown girl at them for thinking her consciously naive. As we shook hands, I made up my mind to take him indoors without referring to the fire. But he looked up at it and said, I'd forgotten it was Midsummer Eve. Rose told me about the fun you always have. How pretty your garland is. Then, somehow, we were walking up the mound together. He had driven down to see the Scotney agent, had been working with him all day. Then I thought I'd come and call on you and your father. Is he out? There are no lights in the castle. I explained about Father, and said he might possibly have turned up at the flat. Then he'll have to sleep in my room. We're like sardines in that apartment. What a glorious blaze! As we sat down, I wondered how much Rose had told him about the rites. I hoped he only knew that we lit a fire for them. Then I saw him look at the basket. How's Rose? I asked quickly to distract him from it. Oh, she's fine. She sent you her love, of course. So did Topaz. Is this the vicar's port that Rose told me about? The medicine bottle was sticking right out of the basket. Yes. He gives me a little every year, I said, feeling most self-conscious. Do we drink it or make a libation? We? Oh, I'm going to celebrate too. I shall represent Rose, even if she does feel too old for it. Suddenly, I stopped feeling self-conscious. It came to me that Simon was one of the few people who would really find Midsummer Rites romantic, that he'd see them as a link with the past, and that they might even help with those English roots he wants to strike. So I said, All right, that'll be lovely, and began to unpack the basket. He watched with much interest. Rose never told me about the packet of cooking herbs. What are they for? We burn them. They're a charm against witchcraft. Of course, they oughtn't to be shop herbs. They should have been gathered by moonlight, but I don't know where to find any that smell nice. He said I must get them from Scotney Herb Garden in the future. It'll be grateful to be used, after being a dead failure in salads. What's the white stuff? That's salt. It wards off bad luck, and turns the flames a lovely blue. And the cake? Well, we show that to the fire before we eat it. Then we drink wine, and throw a few drops into the flames. And then you dance round the fire. I told him I was much too old for that. Not on your life, you're not, said Simon. I'll dance with you. I didn't tell him about the verses I usually say, because I made them up when I was 9, and they are too foolish for words. The high flames were dying down. I could see we should need more kindling if we were to keep the fire spectacular. I had noticed some old wood in the tower, a relic of the days when we often had picnics on the mound. I asked Simon to help me get it. As we came to the tower, he stood still for a moment, looking up at its height against the sky. How tall is it? He asked. It must be 70 or 80 feet, surely. 60, I told him. It looks taller because it's so solitary. It reminds me of a picture I once saw called The Sorcerer's Tower. Can you get to the top? Thomas did a few years ago, but it was very dangerous, and the upper part of the staircase has crumbled a lot more since then. Anyway, there's no place to get out on. if you do get to the top. The roof went hundreds of years ago. Come in and see. We went up the long outside flight of stone steps that leads to the entrance and climbed down the ladder inside. When we looked up at the circle of sky far above us, it was still pale blue, yet filled with stars. It seemed strange to see them there when scarcely any had been visible outside. Enough light came down through the open door for Simon to look around. I showed him the beginning of the spiral staircase, which is stowed away in a sort of bulge. It is up there that I hide this journal. He asked what was through the archway that leads to the opposite bulge. Nothing now, I told him. It's where the garderobes used to be. They should really be called privy chambers or latrines, but garderobes are more mentionable. How many floors were there originally? Three. You can see the staircase outlets to them. There was an entrance floor, a chamber above it, and a dungeon below, here, where we are. I bet they enjoyed sitting feasting while the prisoners clanked in chains below. I told him they probably feasted somewhere else. There must have been much more of Belmont Castle once, though no other traces remain. Most likely this was mainly a watchtower. Mind you don't bump into the bedstead. The bedstead was there when we first came, a double one, rather fancy, now a mass of rusty iron. Father meant to have it moved, but when he saw it, with the cow parsley growing through it, stretching up to the light, he took a fancy to it. Rose and I found it useful to sit on. Mother was always complaining because our white knickers got marked with rust rings from its spirals. "It's pure surrealist," said Simon, laughing. "I can never understand why there are so many derelict iron bedsteads lying about in the country." I said it was probably because they last so long, while other rubbish just moulders away. "What a logical girl you are. I could never have worked that out." He was silent for a moment, staring up into the dim heights of the tower. A late bird flew across the circle of stars and fluttered down to its nest in a high arrow slit. "Can you get it? The feeling of people actually having lived here," he said at last. I knew just what he meant. I used to try to, but they always seemed like figures in a tapestry, not human men and women. It's so far back. But it must mean something to you that one of your ancestors built the tower. It's a pity that the goddess name died out. I'd call my eldest son Etienne de Goddess Cotton if I thought he could get by with it in England. Would you say he could? It'd certainly slay any American child. I said I feared it would slay any child in any country. Then Heloise appeared above us in the doorway, which reminded us to go on with our job of getting wood. I dragged it out from under the rustic table and handed each branch to Simon, who stood halfway up the ladder. The technique Rose and I always used came back to me. When I climbed the ladder at last, Simon helped me out and said, "Look, there's magic for you." The mist from the moat was rolling right up Belmont. Already the lower slopes were veiled. I said, "It's like the night when we saw the shape." "The what?" I told him about it as we carried the branches to the fire. It happened the third year we held the rites, after a very hot, windless day like today. As the mist came towards us, it suddenly formed into a giant shape as high as... oh, higher than the tower. It hung there between us and the castle. It seemed to be falling forward over us. I never felt such terror in my life. And the queer thing was that neither of us tried to run away. We screamed and flung ourselves face downwards before it. It was an elemental, of course. I'd been saying a spell to raise one. He laughed and said it must have been some freak of the mist. "You poor kids. What happened then?" I prayed to God to take it away, and he very obligingly did. Rose was brave enough to look up after a minute or two, and it had vanished. I felt rather sorry for it afterwards. I dare say no one had summoned it since the ancient Britons. Simon laughed again, then looked at me curiously. "You don't by any chance still believe it was an elemental?" "Do I?" I only know that just then I happened to look down towards the oncoming mist. Its first rolling rush was over and it was creeping thinly, and suddenly the memory of that colossal shape came back, so terrifyingly that I very nearly screamed. I managed a feeble laugh instead and began to throw wood on the fire so that I could let the subject drop. Rose believed it was an elemental too, and she was nearly 14 then, and far from fanciful. When the fire was blazing high again, I felt we had better get the rites over. My self-consciousness about them had come back a little, so I was as matter-of-fact as possible. I must say, leaving out the verses made things rather dull. We burnt the salt and the herbs. In America, it is correct to drop the H in herbs. It does sound odd. And shared the cake with Heloise. Simon only had a very small piece because he was full of dinner. Then we drank the vicar's port. There was only one wine glass, so Simon had his out of the medicine bottle, which he said added very interesting overtones. And then we made our libations, with an extra one for Rose. I hoped we could leave things at that, but Simon firmly reminded me about dancing round the fire. In the end, we just ran round 7 times, with Heloise after us barking madly. It was the smallest bit, as if Simon was playing with the children. But I know he didn't mean it, and he was so very kind that I felt I had to pretend I was enjoying myself. I even managed a few wild leaps. Topaz is the girl for leaping. Last year she nearly shook the mound. "What now?" asked Simon, when we flopped down at last. "Don't we sacrifice Heloise?" At the moment she was trying to give us tremendous washings, delighted to have caught us after her long chase. I said, "If we drove her across the embers, it would cure her of Murrin, but she doesn't happen to have it. There's nothing more, except that I usually sit still while the flames die down and try to think myself back into the past." Of course, that was very much in Simon's line. But we didn't get very far into the past because we kept talking. One thing he said was that he would never get used to the miracle of the long English twilight. It had never struck me that we have long twilights. Americans do seem to say things which make the English notice England. A carpet of mist had crept to within a few feet of us, then crept no further. Simon said I must be putting a spell on it. Down by the moat, it had mounted so high that only the castle towers rose clear of it. The fire died quickly. Soon there was nothing but grey smoke drifting in the grey dusk. I asked Simon if we were seeing by the last of the daylight or the first of the moonlight, and really it was hard to tell. Then gradually the moonlight won and the mist shrouding the castle turned silver. "Could anyone paint that?" said Simon.
"Debussy could have done it in music. Are you fond of him?"
I had to admit that I'd never heard a note of Debussy.
"Oh, surely you must have. Not on records or the radio?"
When I told him we had neither a gramophone nor a wireless, he looked staggered. I suppose Americans find it hard to believe there is anyone in the world without such things. He told me they had a new machine at Scotney that changed its own records. I thought he was joking till he began to explain how it worked. He finished by saying, "But why don't I drive you over to hear it now? We'll have some supper." "But you said you were full of dinner," I reminded him.
"Well, I'll talk to you while you eat. And Heloise can have a bone in the kitchen. Look at her trying to rub the dew off her nose with her paws. Come on, this grass is getting very damp." He pulled me to my feet. I was glad to accept because I was fabulously hungry.
Simon stamped out the dying embers while I went up to close the door of the tower. I stood at the top of the steps for a moment, trying to capture the feelings I usually have on Midsummer Eve, for I had been too occupied in entertaining Simon to think about them before. And suddenly I knew that I had been right in fearing this might be my last year for the rites, that if I ever held them again, I should be playing with the children. I only felt the smallest pang of sadness, because the glory of supper at Scotney was stretching ahead of me. But I said to myself that Simon or no Simon, I was going to give the farewell call. A farewell forever this time, not just for a year.
The call is a queer, wordless cry made up of all the vowel sounds. It was thrilling when Rose and I used to make it together. But I do it fairly well by myself. "A-I-O!" I called, and it echoed back from the castle walls as I knew it would. Then Heloise raised her head and howled, and that echoed too. Simon was fascinated. He said it was the best moment of the rites. Walking down Belmont was the oddest sensation. Every step took us deeper into the mist until at last it closed over our heads. It was like being drowned in the ghost of water. "You'd better get a coat," said Simon as we crossed the bridge to the courtyard, "because the car's open. I'll wait for you in it." I ran upstairs to wash my hands. They were dirty from handling the wood, and I put some of the Midsummer Eve scent on my dress and handkerchief. It seemed just right for a supper party. My garland was still fresh, so I wore it outside my coat. But as I hurried downstairs, I decided it might look affected, and it would certainly be longing for a drink, so I dropped it into the moat as I crossed the drawbridge. It wasn't the usual Scotney car, but a new one, very long and low, so low that one feels one is going to bump one's behind on the road. "I think it's a bit too spectacular," said Simon, "but Rose lost her heart to it." The night was beautifully clear once we were well away from the castle. We looked back at it from the high part of the God's End Road and could only see a little hill of mist rising from the moonlit wheat fields. "If you ask me, it's bewitched," said Simon. "Maybe, when I bring you back, we shall find it's gone for keeps." The new car was fascinating to drive in. Our eyes were on a level with the steep banks below the hedges, and every spear of grass stood out brilliantly green in the headlights, seeming more alive than even in the brightest sunshine. We had to go very slowly because of rabbits. Heloise kept trying to go head first through the windscreen after them. One poor creature ran in front of us for such a long time that Simon finally stopped the car and turned the headlights off so that it could summon up the strength of mind to dive into a ditch. While we waited, he lit a cigarette, and then we leaned back looking up at the stars and talking about astronomy and space going on forever and ever, and how very worrying that is. "And, of course, there's eternity," I began. Then God's End Church struck 10, and Simon said we must make up for lost time. There were very few lights on at Scotney. I suddenly wondered if all the servants would be in bed. But the butler came out to meet us. How extraordinary it must be to be able to tell a large, imposing man, "Just bring a tray of supper for Miss Mortmain to the pavilion, will you?" without even apologising for giving trouble so late at night. I apologised myself, and the butler said, "Not at all, miss," but rather distantly, as he stalked away after Heloise. "She knows her way to the kitchen now." It struck me that he would soon be Rose's butler. I wondered if she would ever get used to him. We crossed the dim hall and went out at the back of the house. "Here are your herbs by moonlight," said Simon. "And did you notice how carefully I put my H in?" He led the way through the rather dull little herb garden, the idea of herbs is so much more exciting than the look of them, into the water garden, and turned on the fountains in the middle of the big oval pool. We sat on a stone bench, watching them for a few minutes, then went into the pavilion. Simon only lit one candle. "I'll put it out when I start the phonograph," he said. "Then you can still see the fountains while you listen to Debussy. They go well together." I sat down by one of the three tall arched windows and peered around. I hadn't been in the pavilion since it had been turned into a music room. A large grand piano had arrived as well as the wonderful gramophone, and dozens of albums of records were arranged on the shelves of two painted cupboards. Simon walked along with the candle, looking for the Debussy albums. "I suppose we ought to start you right at the beginning," he said. "But I don't believe we have anything from the children's corner. I'll try Claire de Lune on you. And I bet you'll find you know it." He was right. As soon as it began, I remembered. A girl once played it at a school concert. It is beautiful. And the gramophone was amazing. It might have been someone really playing the piano, only much better than I ever heard a piano played. Then the record changed all by itself. Simon called me away from the window to watch it and told me about the next piece, La Cathédrale Engloutie. You hear the drowned cathedral rise with its bells ringing, then sink into the sea again.
Now you know why I said Debussy could have composed The Castle in the Mist, Simon told me. The third record was La Trace des Audiences au Clair de Lune.
It was wonderful to watch the fountains while I listened to it. There were fountains in the music, too.
Well, Debussy's certainly made a hit with you, said Simon, though I'm not sure you wouldn't outgrow him. You're the kind of child who might develop a passion for Bach. I told him I hadn't at school. The one Bach piece I learned made me feel I was being repeatedly hit on the head with a teaspoon. But I never got very far with my music. The money for lessons ran out when I was 12.
I'll find you some Bach that you really like, said Simon. He lit the candle again and began to hunt through a big album. The gramophone had stopped playing. I went over to the cupboards and looked at the backs of the albums. Even to read the names of the composers was exciting.
You shall hear them all in time, Simon told me. I'd like to try some really modern stuff on you.
What a pity Rose doesn't like music.
I turned to him in astonishment. But she does. She plays much better than I do. She sings, too.
All the same, she doesn't really like it, he said firmly. I took her to a concert, and she looked quite wretched with boredom.
Ah, here's your supper.
It came on a silver tray, and the butler spread a lace cloth on a little table for it. There was jellied soup, cold chicken, all breast, fruit and wine, and lemonade in case I didn't like the wine, but I did. Simon told the butler to light all the candles, and he went round to the crystal wall brackets with a taper in a long holder. It made me feel I was back in the 18th century.
I'm determined not to have electricity in here, said Simon.
When the butler had poured out wine for us both, Simon told him he needn't wait. I was glad because he would have made me feel I ought to bolt my supper. His name, by the way, is Graves. But I've never yet brought myself to call him by it in the nonchalant way one should.
Simon had found the record he wanted. But it must wait until afterwards. I'm not going to let you eat your way through Bach.
He put on some dance records and turned the gramophone very low, then came back and sat at the table with me.
Tell me about Rose, I said, for it suddenly came to me that I had asked very little about her. I had been self-centred.
He talked about the trousseau and how much admired Rose is everywhere.
Topaz is, too, of course. And my mother's a pretty good looker. When the three of them go out together, well, it's something.
I said they needed me to bring the average down, and instantly wished that I hadn't. That kind of a remark simply asks for a compliment.
Simon laughed and told me not to fish. You're far prettier than any girl who's so intelligent has a right to be.
As a matter of fact, he sounded faintly surprised. You're very pretty indeed. I said, I think I'm a bit better looking when Rose isn't around. He laughed again.
Well, you're certainly very pretty tonight.
Then he raised his glass to me, as I once saw him raise it to Rose. I felt myself blushing and hastily changed the conversation.
Have you been doing any writing lately? I asked.
He said he had begun a critical essay on Father, but couldn't bring himself to finish it. There seems no way of not drawing attention to his inactivity. If only one could give the faintest hint that he had something in hand. For a moment I thought of telling him of my hopes, but it would have meant describing Father's recent behaviour, and the idea of putting into words things like his reading Little Folks and studying willow pattern plates made me realise how very peculiar they are. So I let Simon go on talking about his essay, which sounded very much over my head. He must be terribly clever. When I finished my magnificent chicken, he peeled a peach for me. I was glad because it is a job I make a mess of. Simon did it beautifully. I noticed what very fine hands he has. And then I suddenly saw what Topaz meant when she once said that all his lines were good. He was wearing a white silk shirt. He had taken his coat off, and the line of his shoulders seemed exactly right with the line of his jaw. How wise Rose was to get rid of that beard. I had the oddest feeling that I was drawing him. I knew exactly how I would do the little twist of his eyebrows, the curve where his lips pressed together as he concentrated on the peach. And as I drew each stroke in imagination, I felt it delicately traced on my own face, shoulders, arms and hands. Even the folds of the shirt when I drew them seemed to touch me. But the drawn lines made no picture before my eyes. I still saw him as he was, in the flickering candlelight. I had eaten the peach and was drinking the last of my wine when the gramophone began a most fascinating tune. I asked what it was called. "This?" "Lover, I believe," said Simon. "Do you want to dance once? Then I must take you home." He went to turn the gramophone up a little, then came back for me. I had never danced with him before, and was rather nervous. I found it quite difficult that time I danced with Neil. To my surprise, it was far easier with Simon. He holds one more loosely. It seems more casual. I had a feeling of ease and lightness. After the first few seconds, I stopped worrying about following his steps. My feet took care of it on their own. The odd thing is that Neil helps one to follow far more, almost forces one to. Never did I feel any pressure from Simon's hold. The Lover record was the last of the stack, so the gramophone stopped at the end. We were close enough for Simon to restart it without taking his arm from my waist. Then we danced the tune through again without saying one word. Indeed, we never spoke all the time we were dancing. I can't remember that I even thought. I seemed to move with a pleasure that was mindless. When the gramophone stopped again, Simon said, "Thank you, Cassandra," still holding me in his arms and smiling down at me. I smiled back and said, "Thank you, too. It was lovely." And then he bent his head and kissed me. I have tried and tried to remember what I felt. Surely I must have felt surprised. But no sense of it comes back to me. All I can recall is happiness. Happiness in my mind and in my heart and flowing through my whole body. Happiness like the warm cloak of sunlight that fell round me on the tower. It was a darkness, too. And the darkness comes again when I try to recapture the moment. And then I find myself coldly separate, not only from Simon, but from myself as I was then. The figures I see in the candlelit pavilion are strangers to me. The next thing I remember quite normally is the sound of Simon laughing. It was the kindest, most gentle laugh, but it startled me. "You astonishing child," he said. I asked what he meant. "Only that you kiss very nicely." Then he added, teasingly, "You must have had quite a lot of practice." "I never kissed any man in my life before." Instantly, I wished I hadn't said it, for I saw that once he knew I wasn't used to kissing, yet had returned his kiss, he might guess how much it had meant to me. I pulled away from him and ran to the door, only knowing that I wanted to hide my feelings. "Cassandra, stop!" He caught me by the arm just as I got the door open. "Oh, my dear, I'm so sorry. I ought to have known that you'd mind." He hadn't guessed. I could see he just thought I was angry. I managed to pull myself together. "What nonsense, Simon. Of course I didn't mind." "You certainly didn't seem to." He looked worried and puzzled. "But why did you run away from me like that? Good heavens, surely you weren't frightened of me." "Of course I wasn't." "Then why?" I thought of something that might sound reasonable. "Simon, I wasn't frightened, and I didn't mind. How could I mind being kissed by anyone I'm as fond of as I am of you? But afterwards, well, just for a second, I was angry that you'd taken it for granted that you could kiss me." He looked quite stricken. "But I didn't. Not in the way you mean. Can you understand that it was a sudden impulse? Because you've been so sweet all evening, and because..."
I'd enjoyed the dance, and because I like you very much. And because you were missing Rose, perhaps, I put in helpfully. He flushed and said,
I'm damned if I'll pass that. That'd be an insult to both of you.
No.
It was a kiss in your own right, my child.
Anyway, we're making too much of it, I told him. Let's forget it, and please forgive me for being so silly. Now, may I hear the Bach record before I go home? I felt that would set him at his ease a bit.
He still stood looking at me worriedly. I think he was trying to find words to explain more clearly. Then he gave it up.
Very well, we'll play it while I put the candles out.
You sit outside, then my moving round won't disturb you. I'll turn the fountains off so that you'll be able to hear.
I sat on the stone bench watching the dimple water grow smooth. Then the music began in the pavilion, the most gentle, peaceful music I ever heard. Through the three tall windows I could see Simon going slowly round, putting out each candle flame with a small metal hood. Each time I saw the light on his upturned face, and each time the golden windows grew a little dimmer, until at last they were black. Then the record ended, and it was so quiet that I heard the tiny plop of a fish jumping far across the pool.
Well, did I get a customer for Bach? Simon called, as he shut the door of the pavilion behind him.
Yes, indeed.
I could have listened to that forever, I said, and asked the name of the piece. It was Sheep May Safely Graze.
We went on talking about music while we collected Heloise from the kitchen, and all during the drive home I found it quite easy to carry on a casual conversation. It was as if my real feelings were down fathoms deep in my mind, and what we said was just a feathery surface spray. God's End Church was striking 12 as we drew up in front of the gatehouse.
Well, I've managed to get Cinderella home by midnight, said Simon, as he helped me out of the car.
He saw me into the kitchen and lit the candle for me, laughing at the unctuous beeline Heloise made for her basket. I thanked him for my lovely evening, and he thanked me for letting him share in my midsummer rites. He said that was something he would always remember. Then, as he shook hands, he asked, "Am I really forgiven?" I told him of course he was. I made a fuss about nothing.
Heavens, what a prig you'll think me!
He said earnestly, I promise you I won't. I think you're everything that's nice, and thank you again. Then he gave my hand a brisk little squeeze, and the next second the door had closed behind him. I stood absolutely still for a minute or so, then dashed upstairs, up through the bathroom tower and out onto the walls. The mist had cleared away so I could watch the lights of the car travel slowly along the lane, and turn onto the God's End Road. Even after they vanished on the outskirts of the village, I still watched on, and caught one last glimpse of them on the road to Scotney. All the time I stood on the walls, I was in a kind of daze, barely conscious of anything but the moving car, and when I pulled myself together enough to go in and undress, I deliberately held my thoughts away from me. Only when I lay down in darkness did I at last let them flow into my mind. And with them came nothing but happiness, like the happiness I felt when Simon kissed me, but more serene. Oh, I told myself that he belonged to Rose, that I could never win him from her, even if I were wicked enough to try, which I never would be. It made no difference. Just to be in love seemed the most blissful luxury I had ever known. The thought came to me that perhaps it is the loving that counts, not the being loved in return, that perhaps true loving can never know anything but happiness. For a moment, I felt that I had discovered a great truth. And then I happened to catch sight of Miss Blossom's silhouette and heard her say, "Well, you just hang on to that comforting bit of high-thinking, ducky, because you're going to need it." And in some strange, far-off way, I knew that was true. Yet it still made no difference. I fell asleep happier than I had ever been in my life.
Chapter 13. Oh, how bitter it is to read that last line I wrote little over 3 weeks ago. Now, when I cannot even remember what happiness felt like.
I didn't read back any further. I was too afraid of losing the dead, flat, watching myself feeling which has come this morning for the first time. It is utterly dreary, but better than acute wretchedness, and has given me a faint desire to empty my mind into this journal, which will pass a few hours. But shall I be able to write about the wicked thing I did on my birthday? Can I bring myself to describe it fully? Perhaps I can work up to it. Heavens, how miserable the weather has been. Floods of rain, cold winds. My birthday was the only sunny day. Today is warm, but very dull and depressing. I am up on the mound, sitting on the stone steps leading to Belmont Tower. Heloise is with me. It is one of those times when she has to retire from society, and she gets so bored if I leave her shut up by herself. Her leash is safely tied to my belt in case she takes a sudden fancy to go visiting. Cheer up, Heloise, darling. Only a few more days now before you're free. The rain began just after I finished my last entry that Sunday in the attic. When I looked out, I saw great storm clouds blowing up in the evening sky. I hurried down to close any open windows. I still seemed perfectly happy then. I remember telling myself so. As I leaned out to pull the bedroom window in, I noticed how motionless and expectant the wheat seemed. I hoped it was young enough not to mind being battered. Then I looked down and saw that my forgotten garland had drifted round and was lying just below on the grey glass of the moat. The next second down came the rain. Thousands of new shillings seemed to bounce off the water. I had thoughts of rushing out and trying to rescue the garland, but even as I watched it was driven under. Heloise was whimpering at the back door, and though I ran down at once to let her in, she was soaking wet. I dried her, then relit the kitchen fire, which had gone out while I was writing in the attic. I had just got it going when Stephen arrived back from London. I sent him off to change his wet clothes. Then we had tea together, sitting on the fender. I told him about my evening with Simon, but hugging all the secret bits to myself, of course. And then he talked quite a lot about his trip. He seemed much less self-conscious over being photographed, though I gathered he had been embarrassed by the Greek tunic Leader Foxcotton had persuaded him to wear. He said he'd had all his meals with the Foxcottons and slept in a room with gold curtains and gold cupids over the bed. And Aubrey Foxcotton had given him a dressing gown, almost as good as new. I admired it and agreed that they were very kind people. All my resentment of Leader Foxcotton seemed to have vanished. "Did she show you the photographs she took last time?" I asked. "Oh, yes, I saw them." He didn't sound enthusiastic. "Well, when am I going to see them? Didn't she give you any?" "She told me I could take some, but I didn't like to. They're so large and, well, flattering. I'll ask for some next time if you really want to see them."
"You're going again, then?"
"Yes. But for something different." He went very red. "Oh, it's too silly to talk about." I remembered Rose's letter. "Does she want you to go on the pictures?" He said it was nonsense, really. "But there was a man came to dinner last night who has to do with them, and he thought I'd be all right. They got me to read a piece aloud. I'm supposed to go and be tested. That's what they call it. Only I don't know that I'll do it."
"But of course you must, Stephen," I said encouragingly.
He looked at me quickly and asked if I'd like it to be acted. And I suddenly saw that I had been wrong in thinking he had lost interest in me. Though little did I know then how wrong. I had only been asking him questions out of politeness. Nothing but Simon mattered to me in the least. But I tried to sound enthusiastic. "Why, Stephen, it would be splendid. Of course I'd like it."
"Then I'll try. They said they could teach me."
I thought they probably could. He has such a nice speaking voice, though it gets a bit muffled and husky when he feels shy.
"Well, it's most exciting," I said brightly. "Perhaps you'll go to Hollywood."
He grinned and said he didn't think he'd count on that. After we finished tea, he helped me with the washing up and then went over to Four Stones Farm. The Stebbinses were having a party.
I bet Ivy was thrilled about his going on the pictures. Not that anything more has happened about it yet. I went to bed early, still feeling happy. Even the sound of the rain beating on the roof gave me pleasure, because it reminded me that Simon had had all the leaks mended for us. Everything in the lease connected with him has value for me. If someone even mentions his name, it is like a little present to me, and I long to mention it myself. I start subjects leading up to it, and then feel myself going red. I keep swearing to myself not to speak of him again, and then an opportunity occurs and I jump at it. Father came home the next morning with a London telephone directory sticking out of the carpet bag. "Goodness! Are we going to have a telephone?" I asked. "Great heavens, no!" He plonked the bag on one of the kitchen chairs, from which it instantly fell to the floor, throwing out the directory and various other books. Father shoved them back into the bag as fast as he could, but I had time to notice a very fancy little Language of Flowers, Elementary Chinese, and a paper called The Homing Pigeon. "Where's the willow pattern plate?" I asked, trying to make my voice sound casual. "I dropped it on Liverpool Street Station, but it had served its purpose." He turned to go to the gatehouse, then said he'd like a glass of milk first. While I got it for him, I asked if he had stayed at the Cottons' flat. He said, "Oh, yes, I had Simon's room. By the way, he particularly asked to be remembered to you. He said you entertained him very nicely." "Where did you go when he came home yesterday?" "I just stayed on in his room. He went to Neil's hotel, very obliging of him. Simon has a charming nature, unfortunately." "Why unfortunately?" I asked, as I gave him his milk. "Because Rose takes advantage of it," said Father. "But then no man ought to be as much in love as Simon is. It makes one resent the whole female sex." I took the milk jug back to the larder and called over my shoulder, "Well, I did see why it should, considering Rose is in love with him." "Is she?" said Father. And when I stayed in the larder, hoping he would let the subject drop, he called me back. "Are you sure she's in love with him, Cassandra? I'd be interested to know." I said, "Well, she told me she was, and you know how truthful she is." He thought for a minute, then said, "You're right. I can't remember her ever telling a lie. Truthfulness so often goes with ruthlessness." "Yes. Yes, if she says she's in love, she is. And her manner last night was quite compatible with it, given Rose's nature." He put down his empty glass, so I was able to take it to the sink and keep my back to him. "What was her manner like?" I asked. "So damned unresponsive, and so obviously sure of her power over him. Oh, I dare say she can't help it. She's one of the women who oughtn't to be loved too kindly. When they are, some primitive desire for brutality makes them try to provoke it. But if she's really in love, it'll work out all right. Simon's so intelligent that he'll adjust the balance, eventually. Because he isn't weak, I'm sure. It's simply that being so much in love puts a man at a disadvantage." I managed to say, "Oh, I'm sure things will turn out right." And then concentrated on the glass. I never dried a glass so thoroughly in my life. Father started off to the gatehouse again, to my great relief. As he passed me, he said, "Glad we've had this talk. It's eased my mind considerably." It hadn't eased mine. I suppose I ought to have been pleased at hearing him talk so rationally. But I was much too submerged in my own troubles, for that was when misery engulfed me, and guilt too. Everything he said about Simon's feelings for Rose was such agony that I suddenly knew it wasn't only the wonderful luxury of being in love that had been buoying me up. Deep down, in some vague mixed way, I had been letting myself hope that he didn't really care for her, that it was me he loved, and that kissing me would have made him realize it. "You're a fool and worse," I told myself. "You're a would-be thief." Then I began to cry, and when I got out my handkerchief, it smelt of Rose's scent and reminded me I hadn't written to thank her for it. "Before you do, you've got to get your conscience clear," I said to myself sternly. "And you know the way to do it." Things you let yourself imagine happening never do happen. So go ahead, have a wonderful daydream about Simon loving you, marrying you instead of